This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. While the headlines from Washington have been dominated by the fallout from the Mueller report even now, what we're hearing from the voters is that this is not the most pressing issue on their minds. Not at all. For Democrats, in fact, the top concern appears to be not the president, but climate change, according to a new CNN poll. That reflects a new sense of urgency around all of this. Students around the globe are walking out of school on climate strike.
We are in Geneva, Italy, protesting against climate change because politicians today are not willing to do enough about it.
In Britain, the House of Commons just declared that the planet is in a climate emergency.
Must declare an environment and climate emergency.
As many as have that opinion say aye.
Aye.
On the contrary, no. I think the ayes have it.
And as if we needed more evidence of the sense of crisis, the UN last week released the findings of a report describing the potential disappearance of a million varieties of life on Earth. It's all very frightening to read. Bill McKibben has been writing about climate change for decades. His book, The End of Nature, which was published in The New Yorker, has been credited with breaking the news of climate change to a wide public. And our staff writer, Elizabeth Colbert, is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Sixth Extinction, which was excerpted in the magazine. We all spoke last week on the day the UN's findings came out. Bill, you wrote The End of Nature, which was really the first popular book on climate change 30 years ago. What are you seeing now in the current moment that's different than what you've seen before? We've had so many missed opportunities. What's different about now?
Well, one of the things that's different, of course, is it's much easier to see precisely what's going on. I mean, 30 years ago, we were offering warnings. Even 10 years ago, it was still a little hard to make out the precise shape of climate change as it started to affect the planet. Now, I mean, you watch as a California city literally called paradise literally turns into hell inside half an hour. Once people have seen pictures like that, it's no wonder that we begin to see a real uptick in the response. In the last 6 months, we've seen this rise of the demand for a Green New Deal in the Democratic Party. We've seen the people at Extinction Rebellion shut down London, the center of London, for a week, and the Tory-led parliament in the UK declare a climate emergency. And, you know, most poignantly, we've watched a few million school children following the lead of Greta Thunberg in Sweden and walking out of classes. It's not a good sign that we're asking 12-year-olds to solve the problem for us, but it's good that they're stepping up.
Betsy, I think what Bill is saying is that we're at a certain kind of tipping point now, a political tipping point where climate change is concerned that hadn't existed before. How do you perceive the politics around climate change at this moment? Because in many ways, the Trump administration is proactively making the problem much worse.
Yes, I think it's going to be, you know, if we have a history, if we have a future that will look back on this moment, it will be a very interesting moment because we do have these two extraordinary trends happening simultaneously. You know, there is a lot of energy on the street, and for the first time, you know, you have Democratic candidates competing to be the climate candidate with some, you know, very detailed and pretty significant programs to try to wean us off of fossil fuels. At the same time, you have just the most remarkably retrograde administration in Washington, which isn't just not making progress on these issues, but actively rolling back, you know, whatever modest progress was made under the Obama administration. That will take, you know, at a minimum sort of years to undo that. If we decide to undo it, you know, if we don't decide to give them another term. And meanwhile, just the facts in the air, as it were, are really bad. When Bill wrote The End of Nature, CO2 levels in the atmosphere were approximately 350 parts per million. We just hit 415. So things are going, you know, in the wrong direction and very rapidly.
Now, why would Donald Trump, who is not an executive in the oil industry, believe something like, if in fact he believes it, it's just not a tenet of cynicism, that global warming is a Chinese hoax? And why, correspondingly, why is a matter of science a matter of partisan politics? You say that in the Democratic Party believes X, but a lot of Republicans believe otherwise.
Well, this has been kind of a long, you know, history of a combination of moneyed interests and political interests, you know, colluding, as it were, the word of the hour, to make this issue seem to be one of, you know, belief. It has nothing to do with your belief. You know, it has to do with geophysics and geophysics that have been established for quite some time now. And so how we got into the situation, you know, they've taken people out of this, you know, denier complex and put them into top offices in the federal government. And those guys know exactly what they want to undo. And they are pretty systematically going about doing it. And now I think that one of the lessons of the last couple years, unfortunately, is the capacity for human delusion and self-delusion is limitless. So, you know, it's possible that you could administer truth serum to these guys and they would still be saying the same thing because they actually, you know, quote unquote, believe it. I honestly don't know.
What's so striking about the movement in large measure is that it's led very often by kids, by teenagers. In mid-March, nearly 1.5 million kids worldwide went on a climate strike and refused to go to school. Why is this generational shift happening, and what effect is it having?
So young people have been at the forefront of this for quite a while. When we started 350.org, it was myself and 7 undergraduates here at Middlebury. And I think the reason that young people are so involved is because, well, you know, you and I are going to be dead before climate change hits its absolute worst pitch. But if you're in high school right now, that absolute worst pitch comes right in the prime of your life. And if we're not able to take hold of this, then those lives will be completely disrupted. And they've figured that out. That said, keep your eyes peeled, but I think soon there'll be calls for adult strikes, as it were, to follow and back up the kids beginning in the autumn. And I was just looking at the newspapers today. The UN just published a truly remarkable report saying that we're going to lose 1 million species on the planet sometime over the next few decades. And yet, you know, it's in the newspapers, but it's well below the new royal baby and the trade talks with China. And it's that business as usual that's literally doing us in, and we have to figure out how to disrupt it a little.
Betsy, I hate to be a competitive journalist, but when I read the report about the sixth extinction in the UN report, I said, the New Yorker had that 10 years ago when you published in 2009, the very same thing. Well, what is the difference between 2009 and 2019 in terms of the extinction of hundreds of thousands of species on the planet Earth?
Well, I think that, I mean, it's one of those cases where, you know, as I'm sure Bill would say, you don't sort of like to see the news bearing out what you said. But in this case, you know, it really is. The only difference is, you know, more documented destruction, really, and a lot more studies piled on the ones, you know, that were available to us 5-10 years ago. But, you know, the general trend line of biodiversity lost, it's all just playing out, you know, sort of according to plan, unfortunately. And it's true that, you know, global GDP is larger than ever. And at the same time, you know, species loss and destruction of the natural environment, natural world is also greater than ever. And those two things are very intimately linked. And if you only pay attention, you know, to the GDP part, you might say, oh, everything's fine. But I think what the point that this report is really trying to make is those lines are going to cross. You know, people are still dependent on the natural world. All the oxygen we breathe, all the food we eat, all the water, you know, these are biological and geochemical systems that we're still dependent on for better or worse, and we are mucking with them in the most profound ways. I think that that is the message, the take-home message of that report.
Bill, I was really interested to read that you think that the great climate change document of our time is by Pope Francis.
Well, I think that the encyclical that he wrote 3.5 years ago now, Laudato Si, is amazing, mostly because though it takes off from climate change, it's actually a fairly thorough and remarkable critique of modernity. And it talks really about precisely the things that Betsy's been talking about. To understanding this as, yes, a problem of physics and of the need to put up a lot of solar panels and wind turbines, which we now can do because the engineers have made them affordable, but also understanding it as a problem of human beings and their relations with each other. As Francis points out, you know, the last 40 years, this period of time when we've worshipped markets and assumed they solved all problems, has not only spiked the temperature through the roof, it's spiked inequality through the roof, and the two are not unrelated.
How are they related? What is the essential relationship between the two?
One of the things I spent some time doing in this new book is kind of teasing out the history that begins with Ayn Rand and kind of reaches a first zenith in the Reagan administration. And the idea that government is the problem, that if you leave corporations alone, they'll get done what needs doing, this reigning ideology came just at the wrong moment. It came at precisely the moment when we actually needed governments to be doing something very strong to deal with climate change. And that combination of ideology and interest has been enough to suppress our reactions in the crucial 30 years. I mean, David, we're basically out of presidential cycles in order to deal with this problem.
How do you mean? What's the
math? Well, the UN, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, issued their most recent report, and it was by far their most pointed to date. It said if really fundamentally transformative work was not well underway by 2030, then we were not going to catch up with the math of climate change. Physics was going to just be too far ahead in this race. And you know enough about political life in this country or any other to know that a decade is a short period of time. If we want to have anything substantial happening in a decade, then we have got to be doing it right away.
You know, for nearly 20 years that I've been working together with Betsy, the running joke between us is about Betsy's pessimism, which is well-founded, but we managed to joke about it anyway. And Bill, early on in Falter, your new book, you write, "There is one sense in which I am less grim than in my younger days. This book ends with the conviction that resistance to these dangers is at least possible. And I sense in both of you, each in your own way," and it might be different, but each in your own way, "some sense of hope is informing your work now in 2019 the way it might not have 5 years ago." Am I right, Betsy?
I hope I haven't given you that impression, Dave.
he said, hopefully.
Hopefully the dog came home. I think, you know, I'm going to be, I'll play my usual role here.
Eeyore.
You know, I, Yeah, Eeyore. I think that I do see glimmers of hope on a political front, but it's sort of like mountains after mountains after mountains. And I think, as I say, the facts on the ground, climate change, the thing that distinguishes it from a lot of other environmental problems is it's cumulative. You know, it's not something where you can say at the moment you don't like things, you know, let's undo them. There's a lot of time lag in the system. There's a lot of inertia in the system. And we are
in the system, meaning in science, that there's
no, in the climate system. So
right.
We have not yet experienced the full impact of the greenhouse gases we have already put up there. And once we do, you know, in whatever, a decade or so, there's a sort of a long tail to that, you know, we will have put up that much more. So we're always chasing this problem. And you can't decide, once we decide, oh, we really don't like this climate, you don't get the old climate back for, you know, many, many, many generations. So we are fighting a very, very, very uphill battle. And I think, you know, the point that Bill has made, and I agree with it, is it maybe we can avoid, you know, the worst possible future, but I don't think at this point we can avoid a lot of damage.
And we're seeing it already.
We're seeing it, but it's just beginning. And it's not just beginning, then we can turn it around. It's just beginning, and a lot more is built in.
What can be held back, Bill, and what can't be held back at this point?
Well, I mean, look, Betsy's right. The problem with climate change is that it's a timed test. And if you don't solve it fast, then you don't solve it. No one's got a plan for refreezing the Arctic once it's melted. And we've lost now 70 or 80% of the summer sea ice in the Arctic. So that's a tipping point more or less crossed. The oceans are 30% more acidic than they used to. So we're not playing for stopping climate change. We're playing maybe for being able to slow it down to the point where it doesn't make civilizations impossible. I mean, here's the hopeful case, if you want it. 50 years ago, next spring, we had the first Earth Day in 1970. 20 million people, 1 in 10 of the then American population, went into the street. And that anger transformed the flavor of this issue in America. Over the next 4 years, Richard Nixon, who had not an environmental bone in his body, signed every piece of legislation on which we still depend. The Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act that Betsy described as now under siege, those all came because of that outpouring of public energy that shifted the zeitgeist. We better do it again and in spades.
Elizabeth Culbert, Bill McKibben, authors of really the essential works on climate change these last 30 years, thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
Elizabeth Culbert won the Pulitzer Prize for her book, The Sixth Extinction. Bill McKibben's new book is called Falter: Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. What the Constitution Means to Me is the title of a one-person show written and performed by Heidi Schreck. It was also the title of a speech that Schreck used to deliver a very long time ago at high school speech contests. Her show is on Broadway now, and it's something of a surprise hit. In the play, Schreck talks about the protections that the Constitution guarantees and also the lack of protections and how those policies shaped her life and her family's history. What the Constitution Means to Me has been nominated for 2 Tony Awards, and it's become a kind of cultural flashpoint in the era of William Barr, Brett Kavanaugh, and Donald Trump.
The fact is, there was no way for the framers to put down every single right we have. I mean, the right to brush your teeth. Yes, you've got it. But how long do we want this document to be? Here's another example. When I was a little girl, I had an imaginary friend named Reba McEntire. She was not related to the singer. Just because the Constitution does not proclaim the having of imaginary friends as one of my rights does not mean I can be thrown in jail for being friends with Reba McEntire. Isn't that amazing? Think about it for a moment. Our Constitution doesn't tell you all the rights that you have because it doesn't know.
Dorothy Wickenden, who hosts the New Yorker's Political Scene podcast, spoke with Heidi Schreck.
Thank you so much for joining me on a day where you should be sort of kicking back and relaxing before your show tonight.
Thank you. I'm very excited to talk with you.
So I saw the play last week, and I really haven't been able to stop thinking about it. We talk about political news every week, usually about the grotesque real-life theater, political theater, unfolding every day in Washington. But you found such an unlikely way to shed light on the constitutional crisis of the moment. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
When I first began writing this play, I didn't intend to shed light on the constitutional crisis of the moment.
That was some years ago.
It was about 10 years ago. I started exploring the Constitution in relationship to my own family history. I had done this contest as a teenage girl where I would travel the country giving speeches about the Constitution for prize money, and I thought it would be interesting to go back and tell a personal story in relationship to this document that has really shaped our lives and our country. So I never imagined it would become as relevant as it is today. I was really looking at something quite personal and exploring a story that takes place over 4 generations.
It's about as unlikely as a rap musical about Alexander Hamilton.
Exactly. Indeed.
As you were working through the complications of the show, it sounds as though when you started thinking about the 14th Amendment and thinking about your own heritage and the women in your family,
yes,
suddenly the show just made sense and
yes.
Came together. How was that?
So, I mean, the 14th Amendment was one of the Reconstruction Amendments. Part of it is birthright citizenship. So it ensured that former slaves could be considered citizens. It protected their right to vote. And it also guaranteed them and, ideally everyone equal protection under the law. When I decided that the guiding principle of the show was that I was going to take the prompt of the contest seriously and try to draw a personal connection between my own life and the Constitution, which was impossible for me to do at 15 because I didn't know enough about myself or my family or history or the Constitution. When I decided to do that as a 40-year-old, I suddenly realized that so many of the things that had deeply affected my life had a relationship to the 14th Amendment. So those things include birth control. They include abortion, Roe v. Wade. And then I have this history of domestic and sexual violence in my family. And so when I began to look at the Supreme Court cases that were related to physical and sexual violence toward women, I realized that the 14th Amendment had played a vital role in those cases as well. I also learned while studying it that the 14th Amendment was the first time that the word male was explicitly written into the Constitution. So while the 14th Amendment asserted equal protection under the law for everyone, it also made it clear that only male citizens were guaranteed the right to vote.
And I get maybe one of the reasons I particularly like this part of the play is because I've been writing a book about three women who fought for years for abolition and women's rights during the 1800s, in the years leading up to and into the Civil War. And I came across a letter just a couple days before I saw the show that Elizabeth Cady Stanton wrote to Susan B. Anthony in 1866 about the 14th Amendment, which, as you say, purportedly guarantees equal protection under the law. She said they were incensed they knew what the conversation was underway in Congress. And she said if the word male was inserted into the Constitution, it would take women a century to get it out again. Now, that was a bit of an exaggeration, but it did take, as you say in the play, 54 years.
Yes.
So they went on, they unsuccessfully petitioned Congress to demand that the 14th Amendment prohibit disenfranchisement on account of sex as well as race. And, of course, they failed.
Yes, they failed. And as you know, I'm sure what was fascinating about that is that there were states where women were enfranchised, where women could vote, and and progress was being made in terms of women's right to vote. And then that word went in the Constitution, and suddenly it felt like everything was moving backwards.
So you also talk about the 1965 Supreme Court case, Griswold versus Connecticut.
Yes.
And another favorite part of mine, you play an audio recording during the show. So Estelle Griswold was arrested for dispensing birth control at a clinic in New Haven. And Justice William O. Douglas wrote the majority opinion, drawing on the First and the Ninth Amendments,
yes.
I now know, to construe a right to privacy between husband and wife. And while I was sitting there, it just sort of blew my mind to realize again that contraception wasn't legal at the time, and this would make contraception legal for married couples and set a precedent for Roe. So in the recording, and maybe you could talk a little bit about this, how you got the idea to play it and what happens.
Sure. So I was listening. So first of all, I've listened to hundreds and hundreds of hours of Oyez.org. I love it so much. I've listened to all these Supreme Court cases. And I decided to listen to Griswold versus Connecticut so that I could educate myself about birth control, the right to birth control in this country. And the first thing I noticed when I started listening to the case is how uncomfortable all the men were talking about birth control and about women's bodies and about women's health.
The woman who cannot have another child without incurring ill health or death has no other solution to that medical problem.
I just started laughing. And laughing while I was listening to them. I mean, maybe because I am a playwright and an actor and not a legal scholar. Like, that was the thing I was hearing. I was hearing, you know, their performance. I was hearing the way they were talking about these things and the subtext of how they were talking about these things. And I just thought it really brought home for me how ludicrous it was for this decision about women's health, about women's reproduction, about birth control, that the fact that it was being made by all
by
men.
Nine justices.
By who, nine male
how
justices.
Many of whom were having.
Well, so we know that William O. Douglas was having an affair with a 22-year-old college student because he later married her. The other three justices, I only can get people to talk to me about off the record.
Even now.
But definitely, I mean, this is the other thing that that when I listened to this recording that I thought about was just like the hypocrisy of it all. Because the truth is, like, birth control was not constitutionally protected for all women until 1972. But of course, everybody was using birth control. It's not like it didn't exist or people weren't, you know, you could go to the drugstore and buy a condom. Despite the Comstock laws, despite it was being technically illegal in Connecticut. And yet it was so difficult for this court to just come out and say, like, of course, this is a protected right,
so to speak.
Yeah.
You never utter the word Trump in the show.
I don't, no.
And you don't need to. And so just on my way up here from downtown,
yeah.
I was compulsively checking my phone for the news, as people tend to do these days. And the newest headline is, White House asserts executive privilege over the Mueller report. So for the umpteenth time since the election of 2016, people are again talking about a constitutional crisis.
Yes.
And the night I was there in the audience, there was this palpable sense that a cathartic experience was underway.
Right.
What does it feel like for you on stage as you relate to your audience's reactions to the play?
It changes dramatically every night depending on what is happening that day. For example, I performed the show during the Kavanaugh hearings, and the audience was very emotional. There were just audible sounds of grief. There were audible sounds of response. Strangely, during that time period, people voted to abolish the Constitution a lot, maybe because they felt like, because it felt like, for some people, the Supreme Court and the way it operates wasn't working. Although, as you know,
you're referring to the scene at the end of the play.
We debate at the end of the play whether to abolish or keep the Constitution. And during that time period, people were voting to abolish a lot. The day that Trump, that the AP reported that Trump had said he was going to get rid of birthright citizenship, which of course he can't do. But when they reported that, that night, the audience broke into applause when I just simply read the birthright citizenship clause. I just read it in a very neutral voice, and that elicited a huge response from the audience. So I don't change the language of the play very much from night to night, and I never really refer to anything that's happening on that day, but the subtext of the play changes every night, and what people are bringing into the play changes. So right now, people are always voting to keep the Constitution, and I understand. I understand why.
So it's so interesting, because that wasn't all that long ago, the Kavanaugh hearings.
No.
You know, the show does offer a warning and a call to action. And I wonder, when you're looking back on it, say a year or two from now, what do you hope it will have accomplished?
So I don't create things hoping for any particular response. So the fact that it's sort of expanded into this thing that reaches so many people is exciting for me. And I think the only thing I hope for people is that it brings people who maybe are suffering through this moment the way many people are, a sense of community. I mean, that's been true for me, just like the ability to like show up in a room every night and think through what's going on in our country and have space to have feelings about it and to grieve about it and to also find ways to find hope for our future. It's made me a much happier person than I was 2 years ago when I was just scrolling through Twitter in despair on my sofa.
Thank you so much, Heidi. Break a leg tonight.
Thank you so much.
Heidi Schreck is the writer and star of What the Constitution Means to Me, and it's on Broadway now. And it's nominated for 2 Tony Awards. Dorothy Wickenden is executive editor at The New Yorker, and she hosts our podcast, The Political Scene, talking every week with our reporters about the news in Washington and well beyond. Karen Russell is a writer who just loves the outdoors. And her best-known book, Swamplandia, was set in the Everglades. It's about a family of alligator wrestlers at an alligator wrestling theme park. Russell is a native of South Florida, and the state has shaped her very particular and fantastical view of the world. But a few years back, she met a man at a writers' conference in Portland, Oregon. She visited him for the summer and never went back. And that's where we found Karen Russell recently, in Portland, where she took us on a walk through Oaks Bottom Wildlife Refuge.
I live about maybe a 15-minute walk from here, and I come here. There was a period where I came here every single day, and it's one of my favorite places. When we were looking for houses, I discovered it. We hadn't really been up this way, and I went on a jog, and it just felt like Narnia or something. I mean, it's pretty industrial up this way. So you sort of go from a grittier area, and then there was just this green parentheses that opened up, and it feels like the true woods. And it's really surprising to sort of turn off Southeast Milwaukee and find yourself in this like envelope of what I still think of as the real woods. I grew up in Miami, Florida. We have amazing ecosystems down there. But, you know, we don't really have Doug firs and maples and sort of the tremendous woods of the West. So I think this still feels very storybook to me, you know, as a Floridian to come into this kind of forest. I mentioned it's not enormous. It's 144 acres, but it feels enormous. So right now you can't even see the street anymore. And if you could see what I'm looking at, I mean, Portland's totally erased, basically. There's just every kind of green all around us. There's just these felled giants of these old trees. they look like kind of Fraggle Rock meets Dr. Seuss. You know, there's sort of like a Jim Henson quality to them because they're all wearing this fabulous shag of moss. Contributing to the fairy tale dimension of this walk is the fact that many Portlanders have waist-length beards. The first time that I went on a jog in Oaks Bottom, I didn't know any of this was here, and I went on when I had always just kind of gone straight down the trail, and then I kind of turned off. I hadn't even seen this path. Now we're going over what looks like this fairy drawbridge that obviously a troll is sometimes under. I mean, it just feels like a little bit you get like the old Hansel and Gretel panic or something where you're like, wait, maybe I should proceed with caution now. We don't know what's on the other side of this bridge. You really get the sense that the crows are telling you you're trespassing. They're not being impolite about it, but they just want you to know. So now we're walking towards this vast lake that is kind of adjacent to the Willamette. And this is the first moment where you can see, like a hallucination, this Ferris wheel through the trees. There's a really flat meadow, and so you have kind of a clear sight line to the Ferris wheel at Oaks Amusement Park. And the first time I saw this, it was such a shock. I really just doubted the evidence of my senses, you know. Now we've got a cool green musky smell in Wapato Pond, which is just looks like some of the swampier places that I loved when I was growing up. Everything's kind of sunken and watery. Oh my gosh. Is that a nutria or a beaver? We've got just the sweet furry head of a nutria doing donuts in the water below our bridge. Wow. Looking like a piece of bark that just swam to life. A lot of my early work, my first story collection and my first novel, Swamplandia, were set in the wetlands of South Florida. I grew up near a mangrove estuary and would just like muck around for hours. I mean, just thousands of hours as a kid I spent climbing mangroves and wading around. And I think what is so attractive to me as a writer about this kind of space is it feels uncanny in the best way. It feels like Freud's uncanny. And as you see, you know, from this walk we've just taken and from this vista that we're looking out at, it is almost impossible to say where the land ends and where the water begins or which is which. And there's something about that sort of liminal, slippery place that is so exciting to me. You can hear them, right? You can hear the kids on this pirate ship. this metronome on the skyline full of tiny human bodies. Look, we did it. There it is. Okay, this is very exciting because we just walked out of the woods. It feels like it ends pretty abruptly. And now there's this meadow and we're coming up towards the entrance of the amusement park. is an analogy that will only work for some. But I think if you've ever had a psychedelic experience where the palate can change really dramatically over the course of like a relatively brief period of time, now we're out of like the dark green intense period and things are starting to normalize. This is more like the matte color of consensus reality again. So we're sitting on a picnic bench. The miniature choo-choo is doing donuts around us, and you can see kind of the river sparkling through the trees. And we're, our backs are to like what looks like the spine of a giant dragon, this roller coaster. People are carrying these towering ice cream cones around. So I love amusement parks. I keep writing about them. Oaks Park feels a little homespun to me in that way. There's nothing sort of aggressively modern or commercial about it. But I think, yeah, amusement parks, it's humanity at its best. Everybody comes here looking to have a good time, and we've made all of these machines that are like anti-capitalist in a funny way. I mean, they're like go nowhere machines, like do nothing machines. Just plug your body into this machine, and this, far from being like a factory assembly line, it's just a wheel of joy, you know? You're just gonna pulse adrenaline through your body and remember that you're lucky to be alive.
Karen Russell at Oaks Bottom Wildlife Refuge and the Oaks Amusement Park on the Willamette River. Russell's brand new book of short stories is called Orange World. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. And in a minute, Carrie Batten will give us a guided tour of another strange world, the world of SoundCloud rap. Just ahead.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and welcome back. I'm David Remnick. We're going to talk for a minute about SoundCloud. And if you're not familiar with it, SoundCloud is sort of like the YouTube of audio. It's a website and an app, and you post sound files on it instead of videos. For musicians struggling to be heard, though, SoundCloud offers a way to reach huge audiences, especially for rappers. In the music world, SoundCloud rap suddenly became all the rage. One of our music critics, Carrie Batten, has written all about it. So, Carrie, fill me in. What makes SoundCloud rap distinctive? What makes it a thing unto itself?
It started, as many things do, as a countercultural movement, and then I think it very, very quickly became co-opted by the mainstream in a kind of unprecedented way. Very lo-fi, DIY sounding. One synonym for SoundCloud rap is mumble rap. So it's sort of, it doesn't care at all about the craft. It's laughing at the craft of hip hop. It's saying
the craft of enunciation and pacing and delivery.
And syntax, yes. But what it did was it paved the way for this very vast, rapid deconstruction of rap music itself.
So that means what? What has it left behind, and what are you going to play for us today?
Basically, if you look at the hip-hop charts now, it's very difficult to find a song that resembles hip-hop in the traditional sense. Hip-hop is extremely omnivorous, and they're open to any style of music. And you see that some of the youngest and brightest rappers are sort of picking up influences wherever they can find them. They're referencing emo and rock from the 2000s. They idolize Marilyn Manson, and they're doing whatever they want right now.
So where to begin? What's your first choice from the legacy of SoundCloud rap?
So I think Juice WRLD is the name of a rapper, and he's a young guy from Chicago, and he's kind of like a gateway in the SoundCloud rap world. He has one foot in the SoundCloud rap world, one foot in the pop world. It's kind of the later class of SoundCloud rappers, and he has just had enormous success on the charts, on radio, and this song that we're going to listen to is called Ring Ring.
I don't feel like coming to the phone today. I wish everyone would leave me alone. I don't feel like coming to the phone today. Ring, ring, ring.
So this is a pretty poppy sound. What's been the fate of Juice WRLD since his appearance on SoundCloud Rap?
He was kind of very quickly snapped up by Interscope Records. He got a huge record deal, and I think he's released two projects since then of all varying styles, all of which have experienced enormous commercial success, despite the fact that they're not very cohesive. They don't really sound like anything else.
So now we have somebody named Lil Nas X. What's his story?
So he is a kid from Atlanta who started out on an app called TikTok. He's maybe the first TikTok star to really break through to the mainstream. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but it's a kind of a Chinese video editing and sharing app. And so he recorded this song just kind of tinkering around. And I think you will be shocked to hear how little it sounds like rap.
Yeah, I'm gonna take my horse to the old town road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more. I'm gonna take my horse to the old town road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more. I got the horses in the back, horse stock is attached. Head is matted black, got the bushes black to match. Riding on a horse, ha, you can whip your Porsche. I've been in the valley, you ain't been up off that porch. Now can't nobody tell me nothing. You can't tell me nothing. Can't nobody tell me nothing.
I think a lot of people understand hip-hop as a, you know, the attitude of arrogance and of prowess and dominance, but SoundCloud rappers are very much about reveling in their depression and their hatred of the world and their emotional fragilities. I think you heard in that first Juice WRLD song that he's just, I don't feel like coming to the phone today. He's a sad, mopey guy.
Is that the case for Lil Nas X?
No, Lil Nas X is much more of a comedian. I mean, that is one thing that a lot of the SoundCloud rappers have is a comic sensibility. And I think Lil Nas X actually does share that, although he doesn't use that to express sadness. He kind of uses it to play a character and build a world.
Now, I think you've written that there's parallels between the themes and language of SoundCloud rappers and the incel community. Explain what the incel community is for those who might not know.
Right. Incel is short for involuntary celibate, which are it's just this sort of subculture that aligns itself with the alt-right online. Guys who are just upset about the fact that they cannot seem to get a date. They peg the blame onto the women who will not date them, and they think it's this sort of mass conspiracy on the part of women.
But you're not saying these songs are incel. What's uniting them is a kind of mopiness?
A mopiness, and especially with some of the earlier SoundCloud rappers and Juice WRLD, sort of an attitude towards women. And it also aligns very closely with sort of the emo rock of the 2000s, which is like, women suck, they're stupid, they hate me, like I'm all alone.
Now, you've got a third pick, Dominic Fike, who's singing Three Nights.
Three Nights, yes.
signs at the motel under streetlights in the city of palms. Call me what you want when you want if you want. And you can call me names if you call me up. Three nights at the motel under streetlights in the city of palms. Call me what you want when you want if you want. And you can call me names if you call me up. Feel like the least of all your problems. You can't reach me if you want to stay up tonight.
You can call me names if you call me up. I like that. So, Carrie, tell me about Dominic Fike.
He is sort of currently the buzz of the entire music industry. He's somebody who also started as a rapper, qua rapper, and started making this way more poppy, pop rock, guitar strumming, beach bonfire music.
Now, you wrote a piece called How SoundCloud Rap Took Over Everything.
Yes.
And that was published in January 2019. Is it over?
Well, technically the term SoundCloud rap has become passé. This is a style of music that isn't so much dying as it is kind of metastasizing and eating up everything else and then churning it out and coming up with new weird mutations of it.
And not to get all, you know, grandiose about it, but does it have anything to do with the political or economic moment, SoundCloud rap?
It might have something to do with the political moment, but it also has something to do with this social moment of rising numbers of mental illness and, you know, sort of the toxicity of social media and the sort of overall malaise that young people are suffering from these days. Nowadays, it's more pronounced because, A, you're just absorbing so much more information and so many other – and your friends' malaise at all times. And then you're living it all out through social media, so there's a tendency to kind of perform it.
There's so much irony in that explanation because people are obsessed with it and it's making them feel horrible and yet it can't be put away.
Exactly, yes.
Well,
yes.
Now I feel much, much better.
Right, I can't wait to go check Instagram when this is over.
Carrie, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, David.
The New Yorker's Carrie Batten. We talked about Ring Ring by Juice WRLD, Lil Nas X with Old Town Road, and Dominic Fike's Three Nights. That's our show for this week. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. Our team includes Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Terrence Bernardo, Emily Mann, and Mengfei Chen. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.